Trump's New America today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The president-elect talks tough when it comes to immigration, and for some in North Carolina, it's a welcome message.
When it finally happened, like when we knew Trump was going to win, I turned to my buddy and I said, welcome to a new America.
But not everyone in North Carolina feels safe in this new America.
It's not my home because I can't do certain things that a lot of people can do. I want to be able to vote, but I can't vote.
And later, there's an ancient Indian sport called kabaddi, and the U.S. has decided to field a team.
I looked it up on YouTube. First thing I asked, where's the football? Where's the basketball? What type of ball involves the sport?
Pro tip, there is no ball. Plus, a giant straw goat goes up in flames once again in Sweden. That's all ahead today on The World. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. We begin today's show in North Carolina, a state that has yet to settle on who won its governor's race 3 weeks ago, and how that looks to a North Carolinian who had already lost faith in the electoral system in her native Venezuela. But first, the story of one young woman from Mexico who came to North Carolina undocumented when she was a child. President-elect Donald Trump has pledged to crack down on immigration, specifically to deport millions of people living here in the U.S. without legal papers. It's a promise that elicits mixed reactions in this divided country, but for those who could soon be facing deportation, the reaction is anxiety and fear, like this young woman you're about to meet. She's temporarily protected from deportation through a program created by President Obama, but Trump has also vowed to dismantle that program. Here's The World's Jasmine Garsd with our story.
Some stories should not be told. That's a lesson Suli learned in the third grade. They were studying airplanes, and she told her teacher she'd never flown in one, and how her mom carried her from Mexico to North Carolina.
My mom literally walked the desert, a 17-year-old, carrying her two-year-old daughter. She said she got thorns stuck in her shoes, but she couldn't stop. And she said, we got to the point where all we had left to drink was one Coke bottle. So she said she saved it for me because she'd rather I drink it than her. And then it suddenly hit me. I'm like, I don't think I should be telling her this.
That was about 15 years ago. Now she's no longer scared of telling it as we sit on her porch. It's quiet, the suburbs. And while Suli talks, she gets goosebumps, but she says she's not cold.
Part of me feels like I am home, but then there's this part that tells me, but this isn't your home.
There are hundreds of thousands of people like Suli who grew up undocumented in America with no memories from their native country. Her parents are also undocumented. It was around high school when she realized what this meant for her. No driver's license, no work permit, no college. Suli says she became despondent.
And so I just didn't care and I said, what's the point?
But her life changed in 2012 when the Obama administration created a program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. It temporarily protects people like Suli from deportation. More than 740,000 immigrants have enrolled in the program so far. For Suli, it means being able to drive and work legally and study fine arts. She shows me her portfolio.
That's beautiful. It's very water-like.
Yeah, blue's my favorite color.
She'd like to get her master's degree and become an art therapist, but now she's not sure she will be able to. President-elect Donald Trump promises to get tough on immigration and get rid of DACA. It's making Suli rethink her place in America.
It's not my home because I can't do certain things that a lot of people can do. I want to be able to vote, but I can't vote.
Her reflections get cut short by the school bus. Her younger sister is home and runs up to Suli. Of her three siblings, Suli is the only one without legal status, the only one not born here. As she helps with homework, she tells me how on the night of the election, her 9-year-old sister started saying she didn't want her parents to get sent back to Mexico.
And my mom was telling her everything's going to be okay, nothing's going to happen, but if it does, we're a family, and as long as we're together, it's going to be okay. You can do anything you want anywhere in the world.
On election night, I was just stoked. I mean, It was just incredible to see.
Not everyone in North Carolina was afraid after the election. Conrad Pogorzelski leads the college Republicans at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He says immigration reform and getting rid of programs like DACA is needed.
I understand it's not an easy thing to talk about. I understand that these people are coming over here most of the time for a better life, but I think it is something that needs to be addressed, and you have to have rules in place.
He hopes Trump enforces those rules, and it's looking like he will.
When it finally happened, like when we knew Trump was going to win, I turned to my buddy and I said, "Welcome to a new America."
What that new America means for Sully's family is unclear. Sully's mother, Maria, arrives later in the evening. She cleans houses for a living. One of the ladies she works for voted for Trump.
Pues me quedo pensando que digo, bueno, si nos sacan y construyen el muro, ¿quién te va a venir a limpiar tu casa?
Maria thinks to herself, if you build that wall and take us all out, who's going to come clean your dirty house? I doubt white people like you. She feels she's needed in this economy. President-elect Donald Trump talks tough, but he's hardly the first to promise an immigration crackdown. President Obama has deported more people than any other leader. And after over 20 years, Maria is still here. Sully is less sure about the future. She does know she'll put up a fight if the Trump administration takes away her legal status, but she's also tired.
I've gotten to the point where I don't care if I leave. I want to be somewhere I can call home and be able to do all these kind of things, you know? But I don't know.
Her mother, Maria, tells her it's going to be okay. They've faced difficult times before. Just the two of them. Maria always tells her, I gave you the last Coca-Cola. It was the last thing we had, and I wanted you to have it. I always wanted you to have what I didn't. For the world, Jasmine Garst, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Also in North Carolina, they're living a deja vu from Florida's vote in 2000, still waiting for a winner. It's the governor's race in the Tar Heel State that's still not decided. Yesterday, a partial recount was ordered for Durham County. Bottom line, though, as of last night, the incumbent governor, Republican Pat McCrory, trailed his opponent, Democrat Roy Cooper, by some 10,000 votes, and the outcome remains uncertain. Looks like Florida in 2000, or Kenya in 2007, or Ivory Coast in 2010, or fill in the blank.
The situation in North Carolina, I think it's a waiting game and a game that, you know, we should not be playing at this time.
That's Sui-Jin Lee Snyder, an administrative assistant at the North Carolina Justice Center. She was born in Venezuela and recently became a U.S. citizen. She says the lack of certainty about who won the race for governor is taking a toll.
It's making people nervous and very anxious. I think it's time for a decision to be made. And the more that we talk about fraud and we talk about recounting, I think that's making people upset.
Mm. Have you had discussions about the race with your neighbors, and what do they say?
I mean, everybody is very anxious about what's going to happen next and when this is going to happen. Are we going to have a governor this year or not?
Does it all feel a little too deja vu for you?
I still have faith on this system, on the electoral system, and I think we are going to come to realize that there is not that much fraud or there is nothing to be worried about.
So you spent your formative years in Venezuela, a place where, at least at this point, the economy has virtually collapsed and the government has lost much of its legitimacy. And now you're in the U.S., where political polarization is at an all-time high. From what you've seen, Sui-Jin, what happens when faith in a system of government collapses? And how would you compare faith in the systems that govern Venezuela and the U.S. right now?
We're very far away in the U.S. to become Venezuela. I think check and balances in this country is really important, and I think we have that. But if we keep calling the electoral system rigged and that we have fraud and situations like that, I think people are going to lose faith and not going to vote anymore. And to me, that's one of the things that attracted me about being here. It's the fact that I can vote and that I can be free and that I can be safe.
Yeah, and there were fewer voters this year than there were in 2012. What are Venezuelans' degree of faith in their system, would you say?
I think it's pretty low. I think people are jaded and I think they don't believe in the government, and they don't believe in the opposition. I think people are just tired.
Yeah, so you've seen this loss of faith before. How would you convince North Carolinians to vote in greater numbers and not to lose faith?
It's really important for people to understand that this is a privilege and that their voices have to be heard. Coming from a country where we get a lot of fraud and our votes really don't count, I think we have to keep the faith in our system. Think about that. Electing our leaders, it's something that we cannot just take loosely or let others, you know, speak for us.
Sui-Jin, hope you get a governor soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sui-Jin Lee Snyder, born in Venezuela, now a U.S. citizen living in North Carolina. The economy in Venezuela is, to put it mildly, a mess. The socialist government led by President Nicolas Maduro is struggling to cope with the collapse of oil prices, the country's main source of revenue. That's impacted government subsidies, which had kept prices low for many basic goods there. One result of this has been super high inflation. For ordinary Venezuelans, that means their currency, the bolivar, has become almost worthless. Whatever value a bolivar does have is measured by its relationship to the U.S. dollar. And right now, the bolivar-to-dollar exchange rate is pretty much being set by this guy, a man who works at a Home Depot in Hoover, Alabama.
My name is Gustavo Diaz. My website, the name is Dollar Today, and it's an American website focused on Latin American politics and finance.
Okay, let me explain here, because currency exchange rates can be kind of complex. The Venezuelan government sets an official currency exchange rate for the bolivar. Right now, about 10 bolivars for one U.S. dollar. But on the streets of Caracas, a bolivar is worth way less, more like 4,000 to the dollar. That real-life or black market rate is what's being used by most Venezuelans buying and selling goods. But there is a problem. It's illegal in Venezuela to publish black market exchange rates. But Diaz's website does exactly that, from Alabama. And it's become an essential tool for Venezuelans trying to navigate their crumbling economy.
You can go to the website, you find a calculator that tells you, if you put the amount of money you want to exchange in bolivars, $2, you put in the quantity and the calculator give you, because we have the algorithm to do that.
Diaz says he created Dollar Today as a protest against the Venezuelan government, which he calls a dictatorship, and its attempts to control all the information inside the country. So, sometimes even from the restroom at his job at Home Depot, Diaz wages his own war against the Venezuelan government.
The thing about Dollar Today is like we find out the way that from the cyberspace, we can do more harm to the regime as a dictatorship, as a totalitarianism, than doing from there.
Diaz says he's involved because for many Venezuelans, it's a matter of survival right now.
People is starving. People are eating food from the trash. They go for those supermarkets or go to the outside, all those trash they found. People are starving, sometimes eating dog food.
Diaz has long opposed Venezuela's socialist regime. He was granted asylum here in the U.S. back in 2005. Now the government in Caracas is accusing him of running an economic war against Venezuela. Gustavo Diaz wouldn't disagree, and he doesn't care. He continues his shifts at that Home Depot in the hardware department.
The Home Depot, I serve the people. I like to do that because it's a way also to liberate all the stress about what's going on in Venezuela.
But during breaks and after hours, he immerses himself in the Venezuelan economic disaster via his website, Dollar Today. The state of Rio can't pay its bills just 3 months after the Olympics. That's coming up here on The World. Where there were supposed to be cheers, there were tears. That was a scene in Medellin, Colombia last night. A highly anticipated soccer match had been scheduled there, the final of a prestigious South American tournament, the Copa Sudamericana. But as you probably know, the game did not happen because most of the players on the visiting team from Brazil, Chapecoense, were killed in that plane crash earlier this week. Instead, tens of thousands of fans gathered at the stadium in Medellin to pay tribute to the victims. And the same thing happened thousands of miles to the south in Chapecó. That's a small city in southern Brazil where the players were based. My BBC colleague Julia Carneiro was at the stadium for the tribute.
The fans came by the thousands, and the energy here inside the Chapecoense football stadium is overwhelming. Yeah. Everyone here is wearing green tonight, the color of the Chapecoense, and the stadium is now all lit up with people holding up their smartphones. There are people of all ages here, lots of teenagers, lots of parents with their kids. I just met 63-year-old Antonio Pereira. He's older than the team and says he's been following their steps since the beginning. He says that the team means everything to him, that he saw the beginning of the team. He's been following it since it was created back in the 70s, and he was always here, if not in the stadium, following it on television. The names and pictures of all the players that were killed in the crash were just displayed here on a big screen, followed by the words, "Eternal Champions."
The crowd gets louder as the few players still left in the Chapecoense team walk around the pitch, arm in arm. Goalkeeper Marcelo Bueck tells me he didn't go to Colombia because he had recently been sent to the bench.
It was frustrating to be sent to the bench. Then something like this happens, and you start valuing other things, life, for example, and being able to be with your kids. Now every time I leave home and come back, and I see my kids there, I think about the new chance I was given to be with them. Our career as football players is a very short one. Our family is forever, and this has moved me.
While they wait to bury their loved ones, relatives of the victims have been spending most of their time at the stadium. Rosângela Loureiro is here with her son. She was married to the team's captain, Kleber Santana.
I've been coming here to the club headquarters since the accident happened, because staying home is worse. We didn't sleep last night. We just can't sleep. We were together since I was 14 years old.
In the coming days, when the bodies of the victims arrive from Colombia, a collective funeral will be held here in the stadium. Up to 100,000 fans are expected to bid farewell. This is a city united by grief, seeking communion to soothe the pain.
The BBC's Julia Carneiro reporting from Chapecó in southern Brazil. Not too long ago, all eyes were on a much bigger Brazilian city, Rio de Janeiro, as it hosted the Summer Olympics. That was an exciting time for Rio. You remember the dazzling opening ceremony, not to mention all the incredible gold medal performances by the athletes. But those exciting times feel long gone now for cariocas, as Rio residents are known. The state of Rio de Janeiro is struggling to pay its bills, and residents are definitely feeling the pinch. The World's Will Carlos has our story.
3 months after hosting the Summer Olympic Games, the state of Rio is flat broke, and state lawmakers are voting on a draconian set of measures that, among other things, could cut wages and pensions for state cops, teachers and doctors by a third. They're not the only ones feeling the pain. Last week, Rio's municipal opera troupe staged an impromptu performance and protest on the steps of the Teatro Municipal. They were joined by Rio's ballet troupe and orchestra, and these performers are public employees, and they're not being paid.
We have not received our salaries from October.
Ciro da Araújo is with the opera company.
We are going to receive the wages from October only on the 5th of December. So people don't have money. People are waiting on waging on what to pay, if they're going to pay the rent, if they're going to come to work, if they're going to pay any other bills and stuff. So we are not protesting because we want better wages. We want just what was due to us before. You know, it's such a sad situation.
Across the state of Rio, hundreds of thousands of public workers are being paid in installments months late, and the financial crisis is spreading across the city. Outside a state-run hospital in the Tijuca neighbourhood, a doctor tells me the situation inside is absolutely chaotic. A crime wave has swept across the city, with reported street robberies up 44% from this time last year. And in Brazil's largest favela, a library that's an oasis of calm for local kids faces closure.
Glória, Brasil! Glória, Brasil! Glória, Brasil!
State workers are threatening more protests and a general strike that could close down schools and emergency health clinics. The Summer Olympics provided some short-term relief for the local tourism industry here, but now Rio state officials are left trying to figure out just how much money the state gave away to corporate Olympic sponsors in tax breaks and other benefits that have resulted in little long-term economic gain. Rio political scientist Mauricio Santoro is himself a state employee, and he says it's clear the Olympics were no magic pill for the local economy.
What we can say is that it was a bad decision from the financial point of view, and that giving these tax cuts did not result in jobs or economic growth to Rio. And now the state is broken, and it has to cut salaries, pensions. So hundreds of thousands of people are going to suffer very negative impacts because of these decisions.
Back at the theater, the chorus launches into Cidade Maravilhosa, or Marvelous City, Rio's de facto anthem, and the crowd joins in. Later, opera singer Ciro D'Araújo reflects on what's become of his city.
I think the Olympics were like the last ball of the empire, you know. We threw up a party, but we knew that this was going to happen afterwards.
For the world, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. For five decades, a small Swedish town has built a giant goat out of straw. You know, to celebrate the holidays. And almost every year, someone burns it down.
He's living a dangerous life and he's hard to protect. We can't always keep him alive.
The ill-fated Gavle goat. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. What a difference a couple of months have made in Colombia. In early October, voters there narrowly rejected a peace agreement that would have ended more than 50 years of war. The deal was negotiated by the government with the FARC leftist guerrilla group, and critics said the agreement let the rebels off too easy. Fast forward to this week, a new peace agreement has now been officially approved by both houses of the Colombian Congress. Once again, peace is on the horizon. And as for that referendum, well, it turns out the voters did not have the final word here. At least not directly. Luis Gallo is in Bogota covering the story. He says Colombians remain divided on the pros and cons of this peace deal.
So, on the first place, the deal didn't have to go to the polls or go to a vote. It was agreed by the FARC and the government to ratify the deal, being confident that the popular vote would be in their favor. However, how it was passed in the Congress, how the law was set to be implemented, it never had to go to a referendum. However, it does send a mixed message to a lot of Colombians who are still not on board with the new deal that was agreed on. And also, it gives the opposition, you know, a big argument to campaign in the future elections in 2018. And as we saw, the country is just as polarized. So I think also the original referendum vote showed how polarized the country is and split right in the middle. And that's what we're going to see happening through the election campaigning that starts from now until 2018. And the opposition they have their candidates already kind of like picked who are going to lead their campaigns on these votes.
Yeah, so the opposition, I'm talking about people who voted against the peace deal in the referendum. I mean, has this kind of given them extra anger against politicians now in Colombia?
Right, absolutely. And it's been voiced by the leaders of the opposition, who were the biggest, you know, enemies or the against, you know, the biggest opponents to this vote, and also opposed the New Deal after it was reviewed and renegotiated. So what this means is the country is going to be even more polarized. But at the same time, we can't deny that, you know, today, after, you know, the vote was passed in both houses of government and Congress, you know, the FARC has disappeared as an organization. The FARC doesn't exist anymore as an organization. And from now until 6 months from now, that's the time limit for them to return all weapons. So six months from now, the FARC are not going to be armed anymore.
I mean, Luis, you're Colombian. How do you feel about this deal?
I think it's time. I think it's time for us to move on. I think it's time to change this mentality of war that the country has been living in the past 52 years. I think it's a great opportunity to focus on other issues that the country is going through. We can focus on education, on economic issues. And I think war is not going to be the number one issue that people go to the polls for when they choose a president now. And we could finally, you know, move past it and tackle other issues that, you know, that are very pressing for a lot of Colombians.
Your own father was killed by the FARC, right?
Correct.
Would you have preferred for the public to have voted this peace deal in? Do you think it would have had more legitimacy?
I think so, yeah. I think ultimately, everybody wants the most democratic seeming process to ratify, you know, certain law in a country. However, I think Colombians, you know, we chose our Congress and there are representatives to, you know, we've given them the power to negotiate laws that are better for the country. And I have faith in the process, in this political process, and I think it was reflected with these new Congress votes.
How much do you think the Nobel Prize had to do with this deal? Because when the Nobel Committee awarded President Juan Manuel Santos the Peace Prize, they admitted the referendum had failed, but they said they hoped the prize would encourage a new deal in short order. So do you think that helped?
I think it helped. I think it was a great boost. I think it was another push from the international community for Colombia to work, you know, harder to reach this peace. I mean, the thing is, like, peace was so close. It was always, you know, it was pretty much, we had it in our hands and then it, like, evaporated. And yeah, and the government had to act fast. So it was a sign. It was a kind of like a more or less a message from the international community that, you know, Colombia and Colombians should work fast and hard to reach a new deal.
Luis Gallo speaking with us from Colombia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For three decades, Colombian sculptor Doris Salcedo has been paying tribute to the victims of violence, from the disappeared of South America to those killed by gunfire in Chicago. Now she's turned the third floor of a Harvard art museum into a kind of public memorial. Sarah Birnbaum paid a visit.
First thing that strikes me when I walk into the gallery is the hush. The lights are dim. I wince whenever I walk because the walls throw back the echo of my footsteps. Alone in the middle of the room are two pieces of what the artist calls dysfunctional furniture. Imagine two cabinets or hutches like where you'd store dishes. They're pushed over onto their side and piled one atop the other and fused together. A long wooden kitchen table stabs into the cabinets and then juts out the side. The place where the shelves are supposed to go is filled with cement. Mary Schneider Enriquez is the curator of the exhibit. She says when you look at these sculptures, you get a deeply unsettled feeling.
Why would there be cement inside of a bureau? And why would these pieces of furniture be kind of spliced together in a way that is not real? It's a completely kind of irrational and disturbing way, you know? And that all conjures up the sense that something tragic happened.
The artist, Doris Salcedo, started making these sculptures in the late 1980s. At that time, her native Colombia was in the midst of its long civil war. Murder and kidnapping were rampant. Tens of thousands of people were abducted. I walk around the exhibit with Colombian graduate student Angelica Maria Sanchez. These sculptures make me think of a home transformed from a safe space into a danger zone. Sanchez says she sees something else.
how heavy pain can be, is how I interpret it, and heavy by the fact that it's cement.
Sanchez says her family knows that pain. Violence drove her grandfather, mother, and aunts from their home in the countryside to the outskirts of the city of Cali. Like all her friends in Colombia, Sanchez grew up hearing stories of trauma.
My mom and my aunts seeing like dead people floating down the river, and things that you see but you don't want to share with, things that you have to live with but like kind of secret. But always a lot of violence involved and a lot of bodies being hurt.
Sanchez stares at the cement-choked furniture in front of us.
When you have this kind of table, like something like pushed through the cement, the idea is like that table has to continue working as a table anyway. So you can lose your mom, you can lose your dad, you can lose your family. You have to continue pushing and going on.
The artist Doris Salcedo didn't lose a family member in Colombia's long war, but she sits with survivors for days and hears their stories.
I try to place myself in the center of that person and in a way empty myself of everything that I could feel or desire or anything, and try to put that person in my center.
In the beginning of her career, Salcedo's art was focused on the war in Colombia, but since the late 90s, her work has expanded to address violence in other parts of the world. A couple of years ago, Salcedo proposed a tribute to young people killed by gunfire in Chicago. She wanted to construct a plaza on the grounds of a former housing project. Drops of water would come from the ground and gradually spell out the names of gun victims. If someone walks through the plaza, the water would be swept away, but then the droplets would form again into names. Salcedo says it's about our short memory.
If there is a massacre in the States, then you remember the victims for, I don't know, a week or a month or whenever, until another massacre comes, and then we tend to forget the previous victims and start remembering the most recent ones.
Ultimately, Salcedo didn't get the funding or community support to construct the memorial in Chicago, so she's building a similar structure in Madrid. And instead of honoring gun victims, it will honor asylum seekers who have drowned in the Mediterranean. But whether her gaze is on Europe or Chicago or Colombia, her aim is the same.
With my work, I'm trying to actually articulate what violence has taken away from these victims. Violence take away language, take away the possibility of narrating, of telling a story. And art, on the contrary, it's a language. It's creating a language. And it's giving form, and it's giving meaning, and it's giving dignity back.
For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, made a courtesy call to President-elect Donald Trump yesterday. Pretty standard stuff, and usually we'd never know exactly what Sharif and Trump said to each other. But the Pakistani government promptly made an account of the conversation public, including some very effusive language from Trump. He reportedly told Mr. Sharif, "You have a very good reputation. You are a terrific guy." The president-elect also called Pakistan a fantastic country, fantastic place. And Trump's gushing final line, "Please convey to the Pakistani people that they are amazing, and all Pakistanis I've known are exceptional people." Beena Shah is a writer and columnist based in Karachi. She was surprised by Trump's praise of Pakistan and his people, but thinks there's a shrewd reason behind it.
When I look at the word-for-word transcript, what I see is actually Mr. Trump going into businessman mode. I think Donald Trump is most comfortable dealing with people as a business tycoon. And he's probably been told, or he's probably aware, that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is a prime minister, yes, but he's also an extremely successful businessman. And Mr. Sharif has been responsible in large part for overseeing a positive upturn in Pakistan's economy. I think Mr. Trump probably relates to Mr. Sharif businessman to businessman, and is probably thinking about the tremendous business opportunities that there could be potentially between our two countries. And if he did that, he would actually be very shrewd, because business is Mr. Sharif's strength as well. It's fascinating to think about.
I mean, those are kind of hopeful comments. On the other hand, there are some intelligence officials, current and retired, who believe that Pakistan kind of represents some of the most worrying geopolitical scenarios on Earth. So a lot of issues between the U.S. and Pakistan.
Indeed. I mean, India and Pakistan are at a low point in our relationship with each other. There have been cross-border skirmishes. There have been some aggressions. And I think Mr. Trump has expressed an interest in actually stepping in and possibly negotiating between our two countries, negotiating some kind of peace, negotiating some kind of détente. I think he's going to brush aside what he's been told about the foreign policy highs and lows, if you will, between Pakistan and America. I think he's pretty determined that he's going to make a success of it, whether anyone likes it or not.
Yeah, and we can't forget either that Osama bin Laden was hiding out not too far from the capital, Islamabad.
Absolutely. And Donald Trump did tweet about the fact that Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan. So it's not like he's unaware of all these issues, but I think he really wants to focus elsewhere. He wants to focus on economics rather than international relations as such.
I'm just curious, Bina, what would you and many other Pakistanis have expected Trump to say to Pakistan's prime minister?
A less than warm tone. I was expecting a degree of coolness, perhaps, or a degree of formality. But Mr. Trump surprises and exceeds all expectations. Looks like he's going for a very warm, personable relationship with other world leaders. Perhaps he feels a bit of insecurity or tension and wants to alleviate that.
So based on what we know of this conversation, do you think Donald Trump looks a little better in the eyes of Pakistanis today?
I think he looks like he's more willing to come to the table with a more open mind than he had displayed perhaps during the presidential campaign, which can only be good for us. And, you know, I know there will be people in Pakistan who will make much of this, especially in light of the idea that was being pushed by certain quarters that Pakistan faces increasing international isolation. So I think that he's basically given us a bit of a present. Yes, and I think we'll definitely be using that to our advantage wherever we can.
And what was kind of the verdict in mainstream media in Pakistan, that Donald Trump is trying to make a deal with the prime minister, or he's just presenting a nice face? He's just being a nice guy.
No, I think that what the mainstream media is pointing to is that this actually points to the strength of Nawaz Sharif as a leader. So this will be taken by his camp as proof that, no, he's actually in quite a strong position and there's really nothing to worry about. It's business as usual.
Writer and columnist Bina Shah, based in Karachi. Thank you very much, Bina, as always.
Okay, Marco. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. This being the first day of December, how about a Christmas story? Too soon? Nah, you won't think that when you hear about this goat from Sweden. Not a real one, but a gigantic goat made of straw. Every year since 1966, the city of Gävle has built one, and nearly every year someone has burned it down. This year, the poor Gävle goat didn't even last a day. Maria Wahlberg is with the city of Gävle. She told me this year's goat got a nice farewell, at least.
We had a great, great party for him. There were almost 20,000 visitors on the Sunday afternoon. We had star performers, friends of the Gävle goat. And 6 hours after that, he was burned out.
I mean, given how many times someone has burned down the Gävle goat, why wasn't there any security?
There is security. We had two guardians at the time, and we had security cameras, and we had two guardians at the time. But the person that burned down the Gävle goat, he attacked the goat when one of the guards went to the toilet and turned around. So then
no
he did this attack. Yeah. So, but the police have found his winter hat. So now they hope that we can get some traces of DNA in it. So we'll see how it goes with this.
What is the punishment for burning down the Gävle goat?
That depends. The guy who burned it down last year, he had to pay 80,000 Swedish crowns to the government here. There is you can get to jail too if you burn it down. So it depends.
It's crazy. I mean, this is the 50th year, as you say, that Gävle has built the giant straw goat. But in those 50 years, only 14 have survived the Christmas season. Why do people keep wanting to burn this goat down?
I don't really know why, because it has been like a tradition and people are betting too. So that can be
They're betting that the goat will or will not last the whole Christmas season?
Yeah. That could be one thing. And sometimes it's like a spontaneous thing. People are out having a great night out, and then maybe they have got a little much to drink, and they burn it down. So it can happen. He's living a dangerous life, and he's hard to protect.
Yeah, well, you could say all straw goats are risk-prone. Maria, very simple question. What is the symbolism of the goat?
I think it's love. he's very loved all over the world. And I have something good news for you, too, if I can still talk.
Please share.
We have one small copy of the Gavel goat. So this little goat, he stands there now. So now people can have the little one instead. And that was very, very great.
Well, make sure you soak the little replica in a lot of water so they don't burn him up.
Yeah, we have to do that.
So, Maria, if this is a tradition, both building and burning the goat, what do you think is the holiday lesson we can take out of all this?
I think it's the good and the bad. It's a lovely story, but it's a very sad story too, because we get so sad when he burns down.
Maria Wahlberg with the city of Gävle in Sweden. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Finally today, you may have heard they're playing American-style football in India, all part of the NFL's efforts to popularize the sport around the world and build a new audience. Turns out India has a sport that it's trying to export as well. In fact, it just hosted a World Cup. Here's Chavi Sachdev on the ancient sport of Kabaddi.
You don't know it? Well, Kabaddi is kind of a cross between wrestling, rugby, and tag. You have to try to raid your opponent's court while chanting the word Kabaddi over and over. Here in India, we've been playing Kabaddi for 2 millennia. And recently, we've started inviting others to the Kabaddi mat. That includes the US, which sent a team to the World Cup Championship in Ahmedabad last month. Bismarck Charles is on the US team. And he says the chanting, it took some getting used to.
There's no sport like this that you have to actually compete and speak at the same time. So it was something a little bit, you know, strange. But after practicing and working together, we're on tempo now. And now, you know, you say it without even thinking about it.
At the championship arena, the atmosphere was electric. All the India matches sold out immediately. But even the newbie countries drew in Indian fans, like Nipun Parikh.
There are a lot of sports like cricket, which is so famous, like kind of religion in India, which we got it from the British. So if some Indian sport, traditional ancient sport, is adopted by a lot of other countries, why not?
Teams from 12 countries played matches over 2 weeks, culminating in a nail-biting final. There were veterans like Bangladesh and Iran. But for the US, this was their first time. Literally.
Let me just say this, that the match against Iran was our first match on the mat.
Troy Bacon is the team captain. He's a musician and audio engineer back in Florida. And he says the team only got together 2 months before they headed here.
India sent us a coach probably about 3 weeks beforehand to just go over the basics with us. And we've been practicing in Jacksonville, Florida. But literally, this is our first match against Iran was our first time on the mat playing Kabaddi, a full game.
None of them knew anything about Kabaddi. They just responded to a friend's social media post looking for interested athletes.
I looked it up on YouTube. First thing I asked, where's the football? Where's the basketball? What type of ball involves the sport?
That's Ben Marcellus, now the team co-captain. Most of them had played college football, and they picked up Kabaddi pretty quickly. Though there's no ball. They also got a free trip to India out of it, courtesy of the International Kabaddi Federation. But player and organizer Kevin Caldwell says there's something serious for them here too. The US players are all African American.
It's not just coming on this mat and playing a sport and trying to win. This is a leap of faith to show the world that, hey, there are black men in America and we have something to say and we have things to do and we have value to add. And we shall add, and we shall use Kabaddi as a platform. So it's extremely much more deeper than just playing the sport.
And hey, they get to be pioneers of a sport that's poised to take off, says Bismarck Charles.
We're going to be the first to ever, start this sport off, open the door, just pave the way for other Americans. I couldn't say no to that.
The tournament was broadcast on ESPN, but in case you didn't catch it, India won the championship, as it has in every Kabaddi World Cup. The American players went home without a trophy, but they say they're coming back next year. For The World, Chavi Sachdev, Ahmedabad, India.
And that's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.